the Dow up 15 points as we start the program. We'll talk to Frank Sennett from Crane Chicago Business a little bit later about what they're writing about there. Christopher Matthews, who writes for Axios, he's been on the show a couple times, is going to explain Bitcoins for us, or at least give it a shot. I'm pretty thick when it comes to Bitcoins, so I'm not sure he'll have success. But he wrote an interesting piece about China and their sort of conflicting views of that. But we always start on Wednesdays with Terry Savage, terrysavage.com, to talk about personal finance. Terry, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Always happy to be here on Wednesdays.
All right, so before we do, I want to give a shout-out. Do you ever listen to the opening bell? Steve Grzanich, our show here at 5 o'clock.
Early in the morning, I'm just going to say.
It is early, I know. Usually I'm waking up. But Grzanich and a couple other vets of this show were just named to the Dare Mighty Things list of influential media people when it comes to tech in Chicago.
Oh, that's perfect.
So
that's
good for him. Andrea Haynes, who's here from Blue Sky Innovation, was on the list as well. Jim Dahlke from Chicago Inno, and Amy Guth. So that's nice.
That is terrific. Well, I'm going to be giving out some of the innovation awards at the event coming up next month. You know what? Let's get some. We'll get that on.
Okay. All right, cool.
That's a good thing.
All right. So everyone today, I guess, is watching the Fed, right? They have just the terrible.
What Fed? What are you talking about?
Terrible timing. They
what Fed?
Wait until the show is done. No change in the interest rate, but they're going to give us some hints. What's going on?
No. The Fed will is half. I was kidding about what Fed. It is really what the markets are sort of holding their breath about. The Dow's up about 17 and a half points now. Not much going on in the markets because the futures markets are saying it's 50-50 whether they're going to announce an immediate increase in rates, and more interestingly, what they're going to say at the conclusion of their meeting in less than an hour from now, just after we're off the air, about their plans to suck some of the liquidity out of the market. If you want me to define that, I will. But
that's the unwinding?
That's the unwinding. And
sounds like a horror film.
It does. It's a very vampirish, come to think of it. I was thinking of how to explain it. I thought, let's imagine that the Fed had a big wet sponge back in 2008, 2009. They squeezed it and dropped water into the economy. Now they got a dry sponge and they're about to put it into that pool of liquidity and suck it out. What really happened in 20? The Fed goes into the open market, the Treasury bond market, and buys U.S. Treasuries sold by the Treasury Department. Remember, the Fed's really independent. So there's trillions of dollars of IOUs from the U.S. government that we use to finance our deficit. Some of them are in your money market fund. Japan owns a trillion. China owns a trillion and so forth. But they go into that open market when they want to create liquidity. They buy those Treasury bills, notes, and bonds, and they pay for them. They pay the bond dealers. And I used to say when Volcker was doing it, nobody asked him to put his driver's license number on the back of the check. They pay for it and in so doing create new money into the economy. Now, back in 2008, 2009, they not only bought U.S. Treasury securities, which is part of their daily activities, they went out and bought mortgage-backed securities. They bought all kinds of IOUs out there, paying for them with newly created liquidity. So over the last decade, the Fed has accumulated quite a portfolio. Some of the things they bought matured, so they're not still in the portfolio. The Fed got its money back and just took it out of circulation and kept it in its so-called liquidity vault. But they still own $4.5 trillion worth of IOUs, many of them mortgage-backed securities. They are now going into the open marketplace. They're going to tell us how quickly, how often, how frequently, or give us hints, and selling some of that stuff. And as they sell, the buyers pay for it. They pay the Fed because they're buying this stuff. And the Fed just takes that check and kind of tears it up and throws it in the wastebasket. And that's liquidity that's no longer in the banking system.
And that's why they're worried on Wall Street that it might have an impact?
Well, what happens? Let's think about it. There's a couple of ways the Fed can influence interest rates. One is they can just talk about it. In the old days, that worked a lot better than now. They can change interest rates. They can boost the overnight rates, the Fed fund rates that banks trade money among themselves. And that tends to lift the whole level of interest rates. Or they can do what this discussion is open market operations, taking money out of the economy by selling off their portfolio. They have a couple of times now raised interest rates. They have said they're going to do it a third time by the end of the year. We'll see if they say when or how. And they've also said, we're going to start sucking money out of the economy by selling these bonds we own. And when we get paid for them by the bond buyers, we're tearing up the check and taking that liquidity out of the market. That would tend to push up rates, too.
Okay, so there's that. We've been talking a lot about Equifax during our segments here.
Well, this is a big jump.
Yeah, but you were telling me that there now are a lot of phishing scams with people worried about...
A big warning. Well, let me make three quick points before the break. Number one, I suggested, and you can see the links to the websites of all the three credit bureaus, the freeze section at terrysavage.com. I suggested freezing your credit if you are not about to refinance your house, buy a new car, buy life insurance, change jobs, all things where people pull credit reports. Seniors in Illinois, by the way, can freeze their credit reports for free, not $10. The bureaus are allowed to charge $10 to unfreeze if you're a senior. So, but the websites and the phone lines have been jammed. People have emailed me, I can't do it. Then a couple of people said, I did it at 2 a.m. I know it's keeping you up at night.
Right.
You do want to freeze your credit report if you're not going to use it. A couple of other things have been notable. There's been a barrage suddenly of phishing emails, P-H-I-S-H-I-N-G.
Hey, worried about your credit rating?
Not stuff like that. We're your credit card company. I've seen them from two cardish, purportedly.
I see.
They look
okay.
Very official. We know you're worried in the wake of the big credit breach. So click on this link or open this attachment and follow this process. The credit card issuers are not calling you up asking you to do anything right now, or they're not emailing you. And be very, very careful about falling for those phishing links, because the fishers out there, the ones that are trying to scam you, know that you're worried about your credit and you're likely to do that now. Wait, one more thing.
Okay.
So the Wall Street Journal pointed out there hasn't been a mass usage of all this data was collected starting back in March and April. Okay. The question is, what was the ulterior motive? Maybe it wasn't just to get your information so they can up new credit accounts and cell phone accounts and go shopping at Best Buy and mail out big screen TVs, you know. Maybe it's something even more dangerous if it was a state-sponsored terrorism attack. And I'm not speculating, but one of the things I want you to remember now, you heard it, file your tax return early, because this is the kind of data that could be used to file a tax return and claim your refund. The IRS has been hit by that last year.
And there you have it. That is the plot for The Unwinding. We had the title first, and now we have the plot of the horror film.
Well, and we'll see.
We need to take a break. We'll take a break, come back. I want to talk about life insurance.
Oh, big warning.
Terry Savage is here, and she is itching to talk to you about Equifax.
Yeah, well, just this news just hit the tape. The House Financial Services Committee says it is seeking information about trading in Equifax options nearly 3 weeks before the credit reported company.
That's the thing, isn't it?
Disclosed a massive breach. Now, you remember that three of the top executives, including the chief financial officer, sold stock back in June, just right after the company found out about it. That would be, I would consider, trading on material inside information. And the idea that the chief financial officer wouldn't know about that 3 days after a massive breach that affected their entire business. But now, and I had heard this before, there are a bunch of put options being bought, a bet that the stock price would fall worth millions of dollars. So the House Financial Services Committee, the SEC, should be looking into this. They've, of course, fired the two top security officers at Equifax. So this story goes on from a personal finance point of view and from a corporate governance. And
we will be talking about it for a long time to come, I'm sure. Yeah. All right, so insurance policies. You buy them, you put them in the shelf, everything's fine until you need the cash.
Okay. I've just written a column. Don't close your ears because you heard the word insurance. I want to try and save you from a policy failure. So the details are up at terrysavage.com, along with two good links to get an analysis of your policy, one by a Consumer Federation of America affiliate and one by Arthur J. Gallagher subsidiary. That one is free. An analysis to see if any of this stuff is happening. You bought a policy years ago. It was a universal life policy. It meant you put extra money in it. And they illustrated that, boy, you were going to, the interest earnings.
These are the ones you
the
buy
policy.
For an investment These as are, well.
Yeah, this is not term life.
Right.
So if you just have term life, don't worry about it. But universal life allowed you to put extra money in the policy, let it grow tax deferred, and use those growth things to pay the premiums in the future when you were older and weren't working. And the way they illustrated them 15, 20 years ago was 8% interest rates. Well, you and I both know that those policies have dropped down to the minimum, sometimes 2, 3, some still have 4% minimums. And now, just when you're retired and think you're going to need this sometime, maybe in the next 20 years, you're glad you bought a policy for whole life. Because low interest rates, there's not enough money accumulating inside the policy to keep helping you pay the premiums, and that you get a letter from your insurance company that says, sorry, your premium just jumped to $18,000 if you want to keep it going. That's one thing. The other thing is the insurance companies are really worried. They're having to pay out, some of them 4% minimum. They're not earning that much. So they have increased within the policy, the one thing they could do, the deductions they take out for themselves, the cost of insurance, the fees, the charges.
What's the mortality charge you talk about?
The mortality charge is really the cost of insurance.
Okay.
And the other thing that might have happened is you could have a policy loan inside the policy that early on you never repaid, sucked out so much of the crediting in there that all of a sudden you get to be 67, 68, 72, and you get this letter, increase your premiums.
Okay, so we got to run, but there are ways to get information.
So you need to contact the insurance company, read the column at terrysavage.com, get an in-force ledger, which those illustrations, by the way, were not promises of high rates, to see where your policy stands now, how well funded it is. When you get that, you can go to the two companies' links in the current column at terrysavage.com. Do an insurance checkup. Make sure that you don't turn 77 and they say, sorry, your insurance doesn't have enough money.
I mean, what a drag to put something in an investment tool and find out you owe money on it.
Especially at that stage of your life when you can least afford it and you're getting closer probably to needing the benefits of it.
Check it out, terrysavage.com. Great to see you. We'll see you next week.
Absolutely.
It's as if the trading indices have their feet in the blocks and they're waiting for word from the Fed. That should be coming in about a half an hour. But the Dow is up, I think, about a point and a third now. The S&P 500 down a point or two. Everyone waiting to see what Janet Yellen has to say. Well, everyone else is waiting to see what Frank Sennett has to say. He joins us on most Wednesdays and is here to talk about what we can find in Crane Chicago Business this week. Frank, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
I'm raising the interest rate on listeners to the station.
Raise my interest rate every day, my friend. One of the stories, I think, is John Pletz wrote about Raise, which has been really an interesting. It was one of those tech companies that had kind of a cool idea. They've had a bumpy road, and now I don't know if they're moving in a different direction or just what's going on. They're getting a lot of cash, but Raise is this business where it was kind of a trading post, right, for people who got unwanted gift cards. They could sell them to us through Raise and get cash for them or get new gift cards. Or explain for me Raise. I'm kind of getting lost here.
Yeah, so it's a really intuitively good idea for those of us, a lot of dads out there who get gift cards for presents because nobody knows what the hell to buy for us, right? I always just say, don't get anything. It's fine, whatever. You end up with the gift cards. Sometimes you don't need them. They're on your bureau. They're in your wallet. So Raise basically is a marketplace where you can turn those unwanted gift cards into cash. You can, convert that into something you might want.
So I think Raise gets like 15%, which, that's a pretty good trade because I'm not going to go to Orvis ever.
Right. So they take a little cut out of it. You get some cash. Everybody's happy. Your sister in Des Moines doesn't know. You know, she never gets an idea.
Right.
And so, but as you say, it hasn't, hit critical mass. It's not on everybody's lips like Uber or whatever. And so they have just gotten a $60 million finance round. And one of Silicon Valley's best-known venture funds, SL Partners, is one of those that's joining in, as well as PayPal. So some pretty big heavy hitters are putting money into this, thinking that it's a good idea. And rather than pivot, as you suggested, what they're saying right now anyway is that they're going to use all that money to really step up the marketing. So we may see a lot more, ads in our social media feeds or hopefully on the radio maybe or hopefully in Crane Chicago Business, maybe. Who knows? To say, give Raise a try. So they're going to use this to raise awareness.
Weren't there issues as well, though, because there were a lot of sort of fraudulent cards being sold, and people were kind of getting ripped off because they were laundering money through these fake cards. I know that they ran into that a year or two ago, and I'm assuming they've been successful in cleaning that up.
Yeah, I think that they've tightened up their processes. They've also tightened up their staffing. They've got a staffing model that now is smaller. They have 220 staffers. They cut 15% of their staff a year ago. So, yeah, they had some problems with identifying fraudulent cards. They had some problems with their staffing size. Now they feel they're ready to succeed as long as we all know about them. And I guess that remains to be seen.
Well, yeah, I think it's a cool idea. And you talk about a needed business, really, or a nice little niche. And I know they also want to move a little bit toward the mobile payment area, which will make it more convenient for people who use them.
Yeah, and that's why, as John says in this article, that the move of PayPal into funding this is so significant. PayPal is, you know, dominant in online payments. In fact, I think I'm waiting. Don't you owe me a couple hundred bucks? You know,
but that's Venmo, my friend. That's Venmo. I'm not doing that on PayPal.
And so they're hoping that with this, they're going to increase their intelligence and their, you know, ability to get into that space.
All right. Let's move on then to insurance and this company ClearCover, which also is coming into some money and sort of an interesting idea. I'm sitting here in the Allstate Showcase studio and I want to give Allstate a big fat hug, but ClearCover is one of these upstarts that wants to really challenge the established insurance business.
Yeah, so we are here in a city where, you know, Northbrook has Allstate, Bloomington, downstate has State Farm. We've got really heavy hitters in auto insurance, headquartered here in Illinois, and create a lot of jobs. And so I honor that as well. What the startup is trying to do is cut marketing costs, cut overhead, and come in and use an algorithm to determine, you know, how good a driver you are, how good a driver I am, and, you know, perfectly calibrate those rates. And with those three things combined, undercut the big guys and become competitive in the auto insurance space.
And the big guys could do the numbers as well, but they are, you know, they also have a bigger sort of corporate costs and things like that, where ClearCover thinks that they can maybe undercut all of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting to me, the marketing perspective. You know, we just saw that the last story we talked about was about a company, a great idea, and what they fell short on is people being aware of it, people marketing it. We all know Allstate, sponsor of the studio, State Farm, they are known for these wonderfully amazing, great advertising campaigns,
right?
Really good marketing. And there's a lot of money spent on that. But you know what? It pays off in customer acquisition. So it'll be interesting to see if, you know, a startup can get into the space where there's a lot of marketing money, a lot of awareness, and just on price alone, be able to undercut. Obviously, Geico kind of came into that space several decades ago, not in a tech way, but in, you know, the low-cost insurer way, and they carved a niche out for themselves. So there may be room in this space, but it'll be interesting to see. The old ways still may work.
We'll watch. Coming soon to a California near you, right? They're going to start out in California and see what happens after that.
That's right.
We talk a lot about women in tech, women in innovation, and how hard it is sometimes for them to move up to the C level. I mean, it's not just in tech, it's just about anywhere. And I know that there are a couple of high profile women CEOs in Chicago who are stepping down. How do we do in the city when it comes to women at the top?
Yeah, so this is interesting. In 2014, just 3 years ago, Crane Chicago Business put out a list of the 20 most powerful women in Chicago. Five of the top eight in subsequent years, just in the last 3 years, including Eileen Gordon, who just is retiring from Ingredient as its CEO, they have stepped aside and or said they would, and only one of the successors is another woman. So it seems like we're reverting back to a lot of male CEOs, and I don't know if it's a big trend or if it's a, you know, a statistical blip on the radar. And then in addition to that, Sally Blunt, who was the first woman to head a top business school,
right,
just recently announced she's going to leave next year as dean of Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern. So, you know, that's in Chicago. Nationally, the number of Fortune 500 firms run by women rose to 32 this year after dropping to 21 last year. So this may just be a blip in the radar, but it's really fairly noteworthy for Chicago.
I know you guys had a consultant as well look at the numbers, and 8.1% of the biggest public companies in Chicago led by women, which is actually above the national average of 5.8. So we've got that going for us.
Right. Exactly, and that's unchanged from the previous year. So even though there are some headlines being generated, we may be kind of holding serve. But, you know, as you can see, 8.1%, still a very low percentage.
You're right, right.
For a group of people that happen to represent half the population.
I guess no one should spike the ball if you're 3% above 5%, because that's not many percents.
Exactly, but that's why you and I are talking amongst ourselves. Right? I know you have so many high-powered women on as guests. You throw me a bone once in a while. That's nice.
I do, and I will again next Wednesday, Frank Sennett. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you, Steve.
Read more about that and more at chicagobusiness.com. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, we're going to talk to Christopher Matthews at Access, but I want to put in a quick word. You know, last week I told you about this trip I'm leading, a WGN radio trip to Denmark and Norway. We're going to leave on June 8th of next summer. It's a 10-day trip. And we haven't formally started promoting it on the station with recorded spots. I kind of like to fill it up before that. And it looks like we're going to do that. We've got about 15 spots left. It's a cool trip. We'll be taking a ship overnight from Copenhagen to Oslo, a train up into the mountains of Norway, and then the fast boats through the fjords of Norway out to Bergen. It's a really cool trip, but you can find information on it at stevebertrandtravel.com or at wgnradio.com, or send me an email, steve@stevebertrandtravel.com. I'll get you the info, or give me a call at 847-606-6065. But about 15 spots left. We're going to fill it up probably in the next couple of weeks, so I want you to check it out if it's something you're interested in. All right, Christopher Matthews is on a phone line. He writes for Axios. You know, I talk about how I like to start my day with Mike Allen and the digest that he presents every day at Axios.com. Christopher, welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. All right, so Christopher wrote this piece about Bitcoins and the relationship that China has with Bitcoins. And as I started reading it, I realized that even though I thought I had sort of a basic grasp of exactly what Bitcoins are, the more I read, the more I realize I don't. There's a phrase in here about a company that mints $318,000 worth of Bitcoins each day, which threw me for a loop. So, Christopher, explain for me just quickly what a Bitcoin is and how it is that they're produced.
So Bitcoin is a virtual currency that is supported by a decentralized network of participants in this protocol. And these participants basically solve these complex math problems that are written into the protocol, and in return, they are given Bitcoins. And so this solving of the math problems helps verify the transactions that happen on the network, and so that's sort of what holds it all together. So it's, you know, sometimes called minting, sometimes called mining, but that's the basic structure.
So explain that for me again, because if you're good at math, you can get Bitcoins, or these machines that solve these problems, or why is it that math's involved?
Right. These are really powerful computers that basically people lend to the Bitcoin system to help them maintain and verify the transactions. And in return, they're rewarded with Bitcoins.
All right. So if I were to buy such a computer system that I could solve these problems and then I get Bitcoins, what do I do with them?
Well, that's the big question. I mean, there's a lot of people who think that Bitcoin is the currency of the future. Right now, it's not really used for much outside of illegal transactions online to buy drugs and other illicit products. So that's the question. There's a big debate over whether this is something that's really worth anything at all or not.
So are the people who are mining Bitcoins now introducing them into the market, or are they sort of just sitting on them waiting for this currency to take off?
There's a lot of basically just sitting on it. There's trading that occurs. People will buy Bitcoins with dollars or exchange them for dollars. But in terms of where it's being used practically in the economy, there's not much of that going on.
Is it? Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just saying that you know, this may change in the future.
Well, and that's what people are banking on or betting on or mining on, I guess. I mean, what do you think? Is there a future in Bitcoins?
I mean, the idea, economists who study currency like to say that a currency should be a good store of value. It should be able to, and it should be able to be used to buy things. Well, since from September 1st to September 14th, the value of Bitcoin crashed by 34%. And since that time, it has gained back 24%. So in terms of it storing the value of your money, it's not a great tool for that, because it's whipsawing wildly in price, and as we said before, it's not really being used to buy much. So I'm you know, sort of bearish on the future of this as a currency.
Well, that brings us into what you wrote about China and China's relationship with the Bitcoin, because they're tempted, but it also goes against a lot of what they stand for. Explain that for me.
Right. So Bitcoin is very popular in China. There's a lot of people, you know, devoting computer resources to mining these Bitcoins, but also it has been used in the past as a way for the Chinese people to evade government controls on moving money out of the country. And so they are on one side, they want to sort of foster a lot of interest in new technologies. They want to be, you know, competitive in the economy of the future. On the other hand, they don't want people to be able to evade these government controls.
Christopher and Matthews. So
And so recently they sort of banned the commercial trading of these Bitcoins, although they're still allowing people individually to use them and to mine them.
All right. That's Christopher Matthews. You can read more about that and a lot of other things Axios at Axios.com. Interesting story, Christopher. I'll steer people toward the website about Olympic athletes and the ones who lose their medals or don't receive medals because people ahead of them are doping, and the millions and millions of dollars that those people who played by the rules end up losing in endorsements. That was a pretty cool story.
Yeah, thanks. You can read that on Axios.com.
All right. We'll talk again soon.